Welcome to Another Moment in Creation with Diana Wedge, where we explore the world around us from God's perspective.
Dinosaurs, that's the topic today. I'm going to put together a few of the excerpts from some of my previous episodes with some of the most fascinating details currently available on dinos. These references come from earlier episodes, one titled Potatoes with a Side of Dino, Iron, and Feathers. So perk up those ears, we're going to just jump right in. The potato is also found in the Peruvian archaeological record as a design influence of ceramic pottery, often in the shape of vessels. Did you notice I mentioned that people saw and were inspired by the potato so much that they actually created artwork and decoration with them? Ready for your side of dino with that potato? Recall I mentioned the potato was such an important part of life that the Peruvian archaeological record reflects their image on pottery? Now that drawings on pottery artifacts has been mentioned, let's consider dinosaurs on pottery. Naysayers will dispute the pottery artifacts as hoaxes, however, there is actually much debate on the topic. Nonetheless, there are often petroglyph representations of these creatures on caves and canyon walls carved into brass and clay and drawn onto pottery. Regardless, their significance to the people at the time and accepting it as what was seen by people from some time in the past will be discussed for a few minutes. How could the ancient pottery and other known aged artwork artifacts so vividly and in such detail bodily dimensions, comparisons, and scale show dinos? How could this be when we have only been digging them up since the 1800s? The common claim is that people were not in existence when dinosaurs lived, and if no one saw them, how could their images be recreated? If the images were created from stories people told, again, how would they know what they looked like and in such detail? How could the images be so perfect to what we have dug up since the images were created? Have you ever played the assembly line game where you tell the person next to you what you were just told and the message is repeated down a line of people? One person passes the message to the next. The original message gets changed, even unintentionally. Oh, but now just let's remember that the retelling factor does not apply when it comes to the mainstream thought on dinosaurs. That's because the claim is that they were not around when people were. They claim, believe it or not, that people evolved from earlier mouse-sized mammals that were around all through dinosaur time, but didn't get any bigger than a house cat. Only after the dinosaurs disappeared 65 million years ago did mammals, our supposed ancestors, get larger and more varied. That is what famous science researcher Don Lessem tells children who ask Scholastic, a teacher and student resource site for teaching materials. If Mr. Lessem is right, we have no answer for how these perfect dimension and body scale images appear on the artifacts I mentioned. One counter response to the query about how these images could appear on ancient artifacts is that maybe people saw fossilized remains, although I have to question that for reasons I will mention in a few seconds. However, it is not impossible to think a bone, not a complete set, may have been discovered in random situations. In fact, very large teeth were discovered in 1822 by a couple in England. A person who embraces the concept of evolution might choose to believe humans were too stupid to do some things, and yet highly creative to deduce a pile of bones, which most likely would not have been very well dug up to see a whole entire picture of what the creature would have looked like, the head to the neck, the scales, feet, and to the tail. somehow these purported less intelligent humans would have known just how to conduct a proper archaeological dig, which takes a person years to learn, and they were able to put the bones in their proper order because these less intelligent humans would have also understood anatomy and also somehow knew the fullness of the body shape. Then they were able to recreate an artistic representation of it that would last for hundreds of years, almost a millennia. I don't think that's the way it went. Let me share a couple examples with you. Among many identifiable animal carvings is a very clear carved relief of what is believed to be a Stegosaurus dinosaur at the ancient Khmer Temple of Tefrum, part of the Angkor Wat Temple Complex in Siem Reap, Cambodia. I really don't know if I've said that correctly. The temples Wat of Angkor were built between the 9th and 15th centuries. This image at the temple clearly depicts the plates on the animal's back, which specifically resemble a stegosaur. However, skeptics believe that this is simply artistic license. Some will even try to show you more worn carvings and pretend that they are the one in question, but they are deceiving you. It is very well documented by many world-renowned sources, and they claim that the same distinctive kite-shaped upright plates along the backs and spikes on the tails are seen on images of birds in the temple. However, I could not locate those bird depictions to which they refer. They claim that the plates on the animal's back resemble the decorative flourishes found on many other animals in the temple. However, the similar shape for these plates does appear in areas where rows of embellishment outline the framing of larger carvings of worship imagery. Where animals are depicted, it sometimes outlines the entire column in which the animal images are contained. But each animal that we can recognize today, even recognize from fossil remains, is not embellished with this large plate-looking representation decoration, except for this specific creature, and only along the length of its spinal to tail area. The creature is not encircled in it. These plates are distinctive to the Stegosaurus. Let me explain just how fantastic these plates are. They are big, triangle-shaped plates lining the animal's neck, back, and tail. They are arranged in two rows of alternating pairs and at the tip of the tail. They transition into a line of foreboding spikes, each more than 30 centimeters long. The largest plates located over the back and hips are the size of coffee tables. It is entirely possible these people saw these animals, and maybe they were impressed in a deeper way by the magnificence of these enormous plates, unlike other creatures. So impressed that they mimicked their grandeur in embellishments. It's something to consider. In Carlisle, Cumbria, England, Simon Turpin relates to us that there was once a bishop named Richard Bell. He resided at Carlisle Cathedral between 1478 and 1495. He died the following year in 1496 and is now buried in the floor of the cathedral. His tomb, which is inlaid with brass around the edges, shows a nearly 5-foot image of Bishop Bell. Around the edge of the tomb are a number of Latin inscriptions and depictions of various animals, which are clearly identifiable: dog, rat, pig, fish, and bat. Each of those images etched in the brass are clearly visible and easily identifiable. Most fascinating, however, are the images that are strikingly similar to sauropod dinosaurs. One of these images has spike-like projections at the end of its tail, resembling a Shaunosaurus. The other dinosaur in the engraving does not have a spiked or clubbed tail, but both are long-necked, easily distinguished as sauropods, and may very well represent two males fighting. It is an outstanding depiction, and we've only discovered these dinosaurs in fossil records in 1977. Interestingly, there is not only a depiction of a dinosaur on the tomb, but there are also the depictions of dragons, which are synonymous with what we call dinosaurs, and they are found both inside and outside the cathedral in the wood and stone work. One has to ask, how could this be, since the bishop's tomb was sealed and decorated well over 300 years before we started to dig up dinosaur bones, and they became known as a group of animals that roamed the earth? How could the artisan have portrayed the creature's anatomy so correctly? The only way the artisans could have done it is if they had viewed the creatures for themselves or had access to drawings made by other eyewitnesses. It is highly unlikely that someone in the 15th century was able to represent a creature that was not discovered until the 19th century. Moreover, this is not just an isolated depiction of a dinosaur, since there are many others around the world. I'm only listing two here for your consideration. However, there is another possible explanation to ponder. The Bible tells us quite a lot about these amazing creatures, and they existed with people. That could tell us just how these images so clearly depict the creatures we dig up ever so carefully today. So we're back to that question again. Ultimately, how you view these depictions depends on your worldview. Remember, we all see the same facts, but your worldview determines how you interpret the data. Because of their naturalistic preconceptions about Earth's history, evolutionists will go to all kinds of lengths to justify their belief that dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. However, the data suggests the most reasonable explanation is that people who lived during the time frame when the artwork I've mentioned was created actually saw these creatures, confirming the Bible's history. And in case someone has told you different, dinosaurs are in the Bible. They weren't called dinosaurs until 1841 or 1842, depending on what you read. The name means terrible lizard. Just reference Behemoth and Leviathan, particularly in the Book of Job, chapters 40 and 41. These are exceptionally descriptive writings of these beasts. Job 40, verse 17, is only one of many which gives details that only one who saw it could describe. God is talking to Job, and he is speaking as if Job already knows what these creatures look like. Verse 15 says, "Look now at the behemoth which I made along with you." Then verse 17 states that behemoth moves his tail like a cedar. Now let me tell you, some references will say that it is a rhino or elephant. Have you looked at a rhino or elephant tail? It is nothing like a cedar tree. This is just one explicitly detailed account of these massive creatures within these verses. And Leviathan? Well, oh my, you must read Job 41 for yourself. I will tell you that there are some Bible scholars and institutions who denounce these as a literal creature and a literal description. They do this with the book of Genesis too. I wonder at what point they do believe the Bible is truth, especially after dismissing so much of it. Anyway, the fact is that the Bible is indeed written using a variety of literary styles. And yes, some of it is poetic, However, when read in context, you can clearly see a physical description in Job when God himself is making sure Job understands just what he, God, is capable of and has done. The context is the key. Back to reading about Leviathan. If you haven't, do it today. If you have, try checking it out again and remember just how big our God is. Since no one would question whether the potatoes portrayed on ceramic artifacts hundreds of years ago were true depictions of an actual vegetable, and that's because we still have them today, why should we think differently about the dino, except that most likely they were hunted to extinction like many other animals? It's certainly a possibility. Look out! Here they come again! Is iron the key to preserving dinosaur soft tissue? Medical Dr. Elizabeth Mitchell from AIG writes that iron may paradoxically be the key, as evolutionist researchers claim, to preserving dinosaur soft tissue, although they say it suits for the assumed millions of years. We'll talk about that here. Dr. Mitchell states that, quote, more specifically, highly reactive iron atoms are released from proteins when an organism dies. While the organism is alive, iron is sequestered in useful proteins, thus protecting it and preventing it from participating in destructive chemical reactions. It remains impossible to demonstrate just how long such preservation has lasted, despite the evolutionist claims that iron-induced preservation could last millions of years, unquote. In 2005, Dr. Mary Schweitzer identified soft tissue containing red blood cells and blood vessels inside of dinosaur bone. And ever since then, she's been trying to prove that iron could be the connection to make these fossils last for millions of years. However, the actual research that was done on ostrich vessels. And basically, they soaked them in hemoglobin mixture, and after 2 years, they determined that they were pliable, and therefore the giant leap was made that they could also last millions of years. Well, catastrophic burial is still essential in this situation, because preservation of soft tissue requires more than the presence of iron in a dead animal. Rapid burial is needed, and the global flood supplied the rapid burial beneath huge masses of mineral-laden waterborne sediment that's required for the large-scale fossilization that we see in Earth's sedimentary rocks. Burial in these porous sediments where water can flow through, such as the sandstone in which soft tissue containing dinosaur bones have been found, is a further help to preserving delicate soft tissue. The bones of the specimens in which Schweitzer has found soft tissue have been articulated or connected in such a way as to demonstrate normal relationships rather than scattered, which is an additional testimony to their rapid burial. Rapid burial plus the release of biologically bound iron may be the twin keys to keeping dinosaur soft tissue long enough for paleontologists to find. Feather types? That is a whole other discussion of complexity in design. And none of these many kinds of feather variations leans in the direction of scales, nor is there any evidence of transitional forms between any of the feather types. Zoologist Dr. Tony Tholborn, in the Skeptics book, tried to leave readers with the impression that it is a simple matter to change scales into feathers merely by the addition of a chemical, vitamin A. Creation Magazine, in a rebuttal article, made the point that the experiment Dr. Tholborn referred to was on chicken embryos, which already had the genetic information for both scales and feathers. Therefore, it had nothing to do with demonstrating how the genetic information coding for feathers could have arisen in the imagined reptilian ancestors of birds. No serious scientist would expect that such a thing were possible, The reptile does not contain the information for feather construction in its genetic code. It is not a simple matter to change scales into feathers. In 1990, Australian Science magazine featured a written debate between Dr. Carl Wieland with Dr. Andrew Snelling and with Dr. Thalborn. Carl Wieland is a medical doctor and professional speaker, now retired, and Andrew Snelling is a geologist and has also served as senior research scientist and editor of the CEN Technical Journal, which is now the Journal of Creation. Dr. Thalborn re-presented his evidence for transitional structures on the feet of chickens. He anticipated that the response from Dr. Wieland and Dr. Snelling would be the same as before, that feathers on chickens are not impressive, but he assumed transforming lizard scales into feathers would be. In this debate, Dr. Thalborn stated that his opponents may be surprised to learn that rudimentary feather-like structures had been developed experimentally on the epidermis or skin of lizards. Notice carefully the context of this claim concerning lizard skin and the experimental growth of rudimentary feather-like objects. It is specifically in answer to the idea that lizards don't have the genetic information for the complex aerodynamic structures of feathers. Therefore, the implication certainly seems to be that it is not necessary to have the genetic information for feathers in order to make feathers experimentally in reptiles. Unfortunately, under the terms of the debate, no further rebuttal was possible, and most readers of Australian Science magazine would not have bothered to look up the reference Dr. Thalborn gave. However, upon further research, which I always recommend, the experiment in question involved grafting portions of chicken skin on to living reptiles. Such chicken tissues, of course, contain, you guessed it, chicken DNA, which of course contains the information coding for feather production. The omission of this detail by Dr. Thalborn has the effect of greatly strengthening his argument to the casual reader. However, this is highly misleading in its context because of the omission of this crucial information. Creation Magazine's response to this is that if a clever genetic engineer were to splice out the information coding for a feather construction from a chicken embryo and splice it into a reptile embryo to cause it to grow feathers, this would confirm the point that they are trying to make, and that is that such complex information cannot spontaneously arise. It has to be created or transferred from a pre-existing source. And furthermore, that an intelligent mind is required to conduct the experiment. A common theme through all our episodes is the fact that you need to think critically when reading material, especially scientific documents. The topics will often sound quite exciting and groundbreaking, but once you start to read, you realize there are suppositions and different worldviews at play. We have the same facts, we just see things differently based on our worldview, whether God's word is the authority or whether man's word is the authority. You really cannot mix the two. If you have any questions about this episode or any that you've listened to, please feel free to write me at crestonchristianradio@gmail.com. Just reference Diana, Another Moment in Creation. This is Diana signing off until we share another moment in creation together.